There is one correction which has to be made about last night's celebration before you and I can go on together in this happy place. Among the reminiscences that were true or half true or totally fictitious, the one absolute falsehood involved a can of tomato soup. It's bad enough to think of a man mixing it with milk for breakfast one morning without having to carry around the revolting thought that he ate it raw right out of the can. I never did. But all the rest was true, and here for the first and only time in my pulpit life are a few memories from a long time ago. 50 years ago this morning, on a brisk, bright February 18th, 1940, I got into a 1929 Model A Ford and drove 20 miles to preach my first sermon in an obscure Oklahoma town with one bedraggled grocery store and a dusty schoolhouse which doubled as a church on Sundays. The car had more personality than either the preacher or the congregation. Green leather seats, a rumble seat that turned it into a kind of prehistoric convertible, a lever on the steering wheel that must have been a kind of choke, and a four-cylinder motor that ran like a charm. My father bought it for me for the princely sum of $75, and no car I have owned since, regardless of price, has matched the thrill of that one. Henry Ford thought that every car should be black, but with an exquisite color sense, I painted mine maroon, did the wheels in bright orange, hung Cracker Jack prizes inside the roof, and bounced down the gravel road to my first preaching appointment without the faintest notion that it would lead me to you and to last night. I belonged to the kind of church that would allow a 16-year-old boy to preach, which is probably the unpardonable sin the Bible speaks of. But I was armed with several hundred memorized proof texts from the unwritten creed of my denomination, and cloaked in so much ignorance about myself, the world, and the people to whom I was going with the word of life that I recall no stage fright. I am embarrassed now to think of what I said that day, since even the limited theology I had was frequently wrong and in some ways harmful. Some of you hoped I would tell you what the topic was that first day, but I am grateful that I cannot remember and that no record exists. I did talk by telephone with a woman last week who still lives in Ryle, Oklahoma, and who recalls that Sunday morning 50 years ago with perfect clarity, especially, as it turned out from our conversation, the car. I made that trip weekly for 6 or 8 months, but I remember only a couple of things. One was a tall, work-worn farm woman who always came early and was scrunched down in one of the little desk seats when I got there, a wide-brimmed straw hat on her head, and the snuff she dipped already trickling down the creases of her chin. I had never seen that, at least not in church. She and I exchanged the same greeting every Sunday. I would say, "Good morning, Mrs. Aldrich. How are you?" And she would look shyly up from under the hat and mumble the same response each time. Tolerable. Just tolerable. I was too young to imagine how life could be just tolerable for anyone. So I lacked the good sense to ask her for details and enter into her life for a moment. I have one other memory from the Sunday morning when I preached my last sermon there and told my first church goodbye. There was a girl present, a few years older than I, and pretty in an already overworked and faded way, who had the special grace to say to me on that farewell Sunday, "I hope you never lose the common touch." It wasn't the kind of thing people in that place usually said. I barely knew how to understand the compliment or all she meant to say to me, but the words have haunted me ever since. It would be nice to be able to tell her that hers was the first good advice I had from a church and that I tried. That summer, just before I turned 17, I held what our church called a gospel meeting in still another schoolhouse become sanctuary on Sunday, this time in the hill country above Marlton, Arkansas. In those days, 20 miles off the main road in Arkansas could warp you into a century earlier, more like 1840 than 1940. The family chosen to keep the preacher, I think they drew straws and the short straw lost and got to keep him, that family lived so far back in the woods that I had to leave my car, walk up a rocky trail, and ford a small stream to reach the house. My mother had always set a clean and appetizing table, and I was not prepared for what I saw in that house, including breakfast biscuits cooked on top of a wood stove whose insides ran down on the plate when you broke them open, and some other discouraging sights I will omit because I have friends here who are looking forward to a marvelous lunch. There were no screens anywhere, and I did literally wake up one morning to find a large mule with his head completely inside the window, gazing solemnly at the visiting clergyman. I decided after the first day that only two things in that house were safe to eat and drink: some home-bottled grape juice, which appeared to be plentiful, and some little cookies baked so hard and flat I couldn't imagine a germ surviving the oven. So I lived on grape juice and cookies for 2 weeks with, as you might imagine, some inconvenient consequences, and got terribly homesick for the first and only time in my life. We were close to a village called Jerusalem, Arkansas, which seemed appropriate in light of my mission, but the schoolhouse where I preached each night was on a small hill in an otherwise bare valley known as Granny's Hollow. We had very late meetings because the farmers had to finish their chores, hitch up the wagons, and drive several miles to reach the place. I can remember looking across the valleys at dusk to see wagons coming around hillsides and across little streams to bring the family to evening worship. It seemed a pretty place to me, and there were people there who were as good and caring as any I have ever met. They were fierce and uncompromising about their religion, however, and there had been trouble in the hills before I showed up. Baptist and Church of Christ people had feuded bitterly. One Camelite preacher, in fact, had ridden in on a splendid white horse to hold a gospel meeting and had had the horse shot out from under him on the first day. I'm sure I had no better sense than to echo the narrow-minded belief of my own people that hell would be richly populated with Baptists. And so on the third night, a vigorous posse of local Baptist boys showed up, threatening to curtail my sermon and toss me around the room until my theology improved. Fortunately, the Blankenship brothers, John and Sam, were on my side, a pair of Ozark giants who had already shown me how they could lift a car. I am serious. And who came up on the platform that night and sat down in cane chairs beside me while I finished the sermon. Bodyguards, no one in that whole community would have dared to challenge. The Baptist boys did wander in and out of the room, trying to entice the Church of Christ girls to go out for a walk in the moonlight. But under the cold stares of the Blankenship brothers, they had no luck. I think it would be hard for you to imagine how I was being trained in my high school days by older ministers. So I will bring back a forgotten time in American religion and describe it. For 4 years, from the time I was 14 until I was 18 and went away to college, I was trained for hours every week in all the tricks of religious debate. Methodists, Baptists, Presbyterians, Lutherans, Catholics, none of them had the truth as we had it. And if we could entice one of their preachers into a public debate, it was holy war with no quarter and very little courtesy. Baptists, for example, taught at least 30 doctrines that were wrong. So for each one, we listed in our notebook all the arguments they could make in favor of their position, and then all the counterarguments by which we could prove them to be biblically illiterate. I learned a lot about how the Bible can be manipulated and how to win debates, but the harm that did to personality far outweighed any good thing it taught me. And I had to spend years discovering that there is always error on both sides of any argument. I was so caught up in the ferocious joy of defending the faith that I turned down a football scholarship to a better place and paid my own way to a small college in Tennessee with a reputation for being impeccably sound, where we lived like monks, studied day and night with only 2 hours of social life per week, and where, I must admit, I learned what it meant to be a student. Most of us supported ourselves by appointment preaching on weekends. And I recall driving to Shiloh, Tennessee to preach one winter Sunday in the chapel on the site of the great Civil War battle. When I got there, half an hour early, the little chapel was freezing cold. I found some wood and built a fire in the wood stove, preached the sermon in my overcoat, and served communion because no one else had planned to do it. The choir will shrink at this thought, but I also led the singing because there was no one else willing to do that either. When I got back to the college that afternoon and walked into the parlor of the boys' dorm, it was like an anthill that had been poked with a stick. They were delighted to swarm over me because I was the only person in town who hadn't heard the news. It was December the 7th, 1941. We all knew that night that our lives would never be quite the same. But our studies went on for a while before we began to separate. And the weekends, as usual, were spent in churches with no minister or where the minister was off on vacation. I remember driving to Birmingham, Alabama one weekend to do that and stumbling into a rather odd church quarrel. When I said that day, as I usually did, "Will you stand, please, for the prayer and remain standing for the song?" a passionate elder leapt to his feet and shouted, "We will kneel in prayer as the Bible teaches." And some of them knelt, and some of them stood, and I mumbled something or other and hoped things would get better. One veered from week to week between tragedy and comedy. Paul and Peggy McGee, who were with us at the roast last night, may have been present one Sunday morning in the Harding College Church where I was doing the fall meeting and where a mentally disturbed woman, wife of one of the faculty, stood up before an audience of over 1,000 people and began a wild commentary on the sermon while it was still in progress. I'd been talking about the demoniac. It was an unfortunate topic, as it turned out. Out of whom Jesus cast evil spirits, and I think she felt that the sermon had been planned with her in mind, and she wanted to make a rebuttal. The college president escorted her out of the room, but it was not an easy sermon to finish. There were lighter moments. I recall an attorney in my first church as a married minister, a fine man by the name of Louis Beck, whose son, A.C., you may know, at North Texas State, whose tireless loyalty kept the church going. Louis was short and extremely plump, so that the folding chairs we used always seemed rather at risk beneath him. And there was a Sunday morning when I was trying to do a sermon about what it means to be petty and what it means to be magnanimous, and when at the exact second that I said, "There are moments in our lives when our littleness or our bigness may be dramatically revealed," Louis crossed his legs, threw all his bulk on one side of the chair, and collapsed on the floor in a pile of wooden slats. Good sport that he was, he led the laughter. I've tried to be light in this reminiscence, partly because I share the more philosophical stuff every week with this church, and partly because, with some very special friends sitting in front of me, I'm not sure I could handle a disclosure of what ministry has meant on its deepest and most emotional levels. This is the only Sunday I have had, or will ever have, in which I can justify remembering the first years for their own sake and without regard for what they taught or whether they taught anything at all. I would like to tell you how important it is to have a strong and patient wife who from time to time knows how to rub one's face in reality. Not all of Billy's best put-downs are repeatable in a place like this. But here is a sample of ones that are. I find sermons difficult to put together. And sometimes, when the going is especially hard, I get very touchy about interruptions that break an already feeble chain of thought. One day, after a couple of reasonable interruptions, which nevertheless left me stranded and wondering how to get started again, I heard Billy coming up the stairs to the study, and in a moment of self-preservation, I reached out and closed the door in her face. She didn't open it. She did something much better. A disembodied and devastating voice floated through the door. "Well, well, I gather that the minister is hard at work on his sermon about patience." The only good thing about that moment was that I was able to work it effectively into the sermon. which, by the way, illustrates a conviction I came to hold that one should preach inductively. I was taught differently in my teens, taught to perceive life as a series of neat deductive ultimates. Here are the maxims, now apply them to your life. I came to realize that the people to whom I spoke lived in a world without points and subpoints, that their chaotic week could not be put into outline form, that their sick children and burnt toast would not take Roman numerals. I started to pay more attention to the living path I walked each week on the way to the pulpit, the siren screaming on Central, and somebody's 16-year-old son lying dead beside his motorcycle, the irritated mother slapping her toddler in the supermarket repeatedly until it became obvious that she liked doing it, the sound of teenagers practicing a new profanity, the vacant look of children abandoned in their own backyards and trying to talk to chain-link fences. When I could find my text there and then throw light on it from the wisdom of Scripture, I felt that what was said might be useful to someone. No piece of advice about preaching ever influenced me more profoundly than Emerson's remark that the capital secret of pulpit ministry is to convert life into truth. Even so, the terror of preaching is that there are 52 Sundays in every year when something inspirational or at least moderately sensible is expected from the pulpit. And I will admit that once in a while I have wanted to do what a Minnesota columnist did one week in the Carver County Herald, explaining why his column was missing. There was the usual logo, and under it, one bare and lonely statement. Stan Rolfsrud has nothing to say this week. That excuse doesn't work very well with parishioners who have gotten out of bed and driven to church in the hope of hearing something. The good news is that even when one preaches unworthily, it is, thanks to the audience, never totally in vain. As Mr. Emerson also said in that essay, there is a good ear in some people that draws supplies to virtue out of very indifferent nutriment. There is poetic truth concealed in all the commonplaces of prayer and of sermons, and though foolishly spoken, they may be wisely heard. And that, when all else has been said, may be the best hope for us.